Hello, and welcome to the first episode of Tea at the Palace. It's a brand new podcast where myself, Robert Hardman, royal biographer, and my fellow royal expert, Wesley Kerr, take you beyond the palace gates. We explore the great royal stories of modern times and the stories behind the stories.
This podcast is all about sharing the moments, memories, and insights that you generally won't hear anywhere else. And we won't be alone with these insights. We'll be joined each week by very special guests with their own personal stories of what they saw close up to the royals.
And it's all going to be over a nice cup of tea. So forget the royal dramas, forget the soaps. They are very watchable, of course, but they're not what really happened. This is. So Wes, let's start by just reflecting on where you and I actually met.
It was this most astonishing royal tour in South America, the only Commonwealth country in South America, Guyana, with the sort of huge rainforests and vast wooden buildings. And the Britannia hadn't arrived yet on this three-week tour, so we're actually in the same hotel as the Queen and the royal household. You'd be shooed out of the lift because the Queen was in it. You'd go to the swimming pool and there would be the royal household luxuriating. And we really met the Queen every day for 3 weeks,
And what year was this?
1994. So it was the last big tour of a Commonwealth series of countries using Britannia.
Yes, I mean, to me, it stands out as one of those sort of old-style tours where the Queen would be away from the country for weeks on end. But she went from Guyana, she went to Belize, to Jamaica.
Cayman Islands, Bahamas, Bermuda. I mean, very difficult assignment, of course. And I remember we, for some reason, had a two-day stopover in Miami. But we were on the VC-10 with the royal party, which was very interesting because they changed into sort of weekend house party gear the moment the plane took off, and they were rushing around to get their uniforms on when we arrived in a new country. We were in the motorcades.
Yeah.
I've still got the Panama hat that I bought to look more gentlemanly. And we just met her every day. She said things to me like, "Did you see your father, Mr. Kerr? And did he see me?"
Where would you have seen your father then?
In Jamaica. Mm-hmm. So the particular interest I think she had, she probably hadn't been accompanied on a Caribbean tour with somebody whose parents were from the Caribbean. So we were almost seeing it through the same eyes. And memorably, I said to her, there's something that you and I uniquely have of anybody else in the room of 200 people. And the courtiers were a bit worried. What was I going to say? But it was that the England cricket team were touring. And because we both supported, as it were, both sides, she was head of state. and then there was a wonderful moment where I was recording a broadcast back to London for the BBC. But little did I know that the Duke and the Queen in Bermuda were lurking outside. And as I finished, their heads came round and they did like a comical wave.
Well, listen, I was going to ask you, what's your sort of standout story? Maybe that was one of them. Do you have any other sort of standout royal stories from all those years?
Well, I think two things. I think one is just the insights into their love of each other, really. How whenever they were seated at a huge banquet at different tables, they always seated so they could see each other. He would sort of fiddle with his hair and play with his cufflinks when she was coming into a room. She would visibly warm up. And then just the most momentous moment of the reign for me, which was the week that Diana died, and I was doing the live coverage for BBC as they came back to Buckingham Palace and got out of the car into what might have been a hostile crowd. And the mood was turned round. And then I heard her a couple of hours later rehearsing that famous broadcast, speaking as your queen and as a grandmother. So I've never seen more powerful personal leadership and jeopardy.
That's fascinating. I mean, I look back myself and I think, you know, what were the moments that kind of stand out? And I mean, things like, for example, driving around Windsor Great Park with Prince Philip. He was ranger of the Great Park.
Oh, yes.
And I was writing a BBC documentary about it, and I mean, you couldn't ask for a better guided tour than sitting in the Duke's Range Rover, even if you did have to keep your wits about you. And another time, actually, going for a walk around the garden at Highgrove
with
the King, now King, then Prince of Wales. That was fascinating. Or going to I do remember a trip to South America with the Princess of Wales, with Diana, and we ended up in Patagonia whale watching, and the joy among the royal correspondence when she went whale watching, and we actually had the headline, Princess of Wales meets real whales. now, listen, before we start, I think every time we have one of these podcasts, we're going to ask our guest to bring in a piece of royal memorabilia, just to possibly bring back a few memories. I'm going to start, Wesley, by asking you, what have you brought in today?
Well, this is something that the Queen gave me the last time we had a proper conversation.
And what is it?
So I'm an officer of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, an OBE, it's called.
Oh,
it's a very beautiful thing, in fact. And what are you doing now, Mr. Kerr, she said to me as she gave it to me in Windsor. And it was just the most wonderful day. My elderly sister said, this is the best day of my life.
And it that's what they always say about investitures, isn't it? We are, they say at the palace, we're in the happiness business.
Yes.
Those are very special moments. People always remember them.
And there was a fantastic secret drinks party in which only six of the honorees that day were invited to.
You were one of them.
So I don't know if you've got a medal or if you've been invited to one of these secret drinks parties.
Thank you so much for asking me that, Wesley. No, I don't have any medal at all. I brought my, this is my, your, does this ring any bells? Are you going to hear something now? This is...
Ah,
do you know what that is?
I have no idea.
That is a clicker. It was a cricket. It was issued to airborne troops just before the Normandy landings in 1944, so they could recognise each other in the dark, and they could just do this, they could do that. And I've always kept it because it reminds me of, I think perhaps, the greatest day in God knows how many years of writing and following the royal family around, but the 50th anniversary of D-Day in 1994. We all got on the Royal Yacht Britannia to, if you like, reinvade France with the leaders of the free world. You had people like Bill Clinton on board and Lech Walesa and all the leaders of all the allied countries. We went back and there were thousands of veterans there to see the Queen. They'd been her father's men. And it was just incredibly moving to see them all lined up on the beaches where they'd landed all those years ago. Anyway, that's my bit of memorabilia and I'm very fond of it. Now, as we look ahead to the coronation of Charles III. For our opening episode, I think we want to, well, let's look back at where the Queen's reign, where it all started. Let's go back 70 years to June 2nd, 1953, the start of the longest reign in British history.
A really astonishing event. She'd become Queen in February 1952, but it took 16 months to prepare the event, and who knows what this spectacle is going to be like, but this was the most remarkable public spectacle in British history and in the first great television spectacle.
Yeah, and today we are going to talk to two people who are actually there inside Westminster Abbey. But maybe we could just sort of start by setting the scene, Wes, because there were a number of challenges along the way, weren't there? I mean, not least how the rest of the world were going to see it.
I mean, I think there was a big issue because Britain had been, really on its uppers. There was still rationing. The country hadn't really fully recovered from the Second World War. There'd been vast economic difficulty, enormous social change. But there was a sense of a new beginning. There'd been this thing called the Festival of Britain. There was the National Health Service. So it was a new corporatist Britain. The empire had become the Commonwealth. Decolonization had begun. So could this rather attractive young lady also be a poster girl for a new Britain, for a new Elizabethan age? And how was it all to be portrayed?
And how, of course, crucially, how was it going to be viewed by everybody else? Because there were then 8,000 seats in the Abbey for the coronation, this coronation of Charles III. There were only 2,000. But even with 8,000 seats in the Abbey, millions of people felt that in the new modern Britain you've just described, that they should have a seat too. And so there was this whole debate about should it be televised? And it's fascinating when you look in the files, because to begin with, actually, the Queen, Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister, the Archbishop of Canterbury, all the great and the good, they didn't want the TV cameras in there because they were worried they might pick up a mistake.
And television really was a completely new thing. I mean, there'd been a limited experiment with it before the war. It wasn't something that everybody had until the coronation coming up. People said eventually, oh, let's not worry about a mistake. Let's not worry about intruding on the mystique. We'll keep the anointing secret and not see that, but every other aspect of it will be revealed. And this is a chance to project the monarchy, to project Britain. It is worth remembering that coronations, and I think Charles's is the 40th coronation since William the Conqueror, but they used to almost be sort of private affairs or London affairs with just people in the procession or in the parks.
And things used to go very wrong. I mean, that's one of the reasons they didn't want it on the telly. But there was this, if you like, this sort of rearguard action by the BBC, by the press, and by a lot of MPs from across the board in Parliament saying, look, this is a new Britain. People have a right to see this. And I think it slightly sort of spooked Churchill and the great and the good. And they decided, OK, we'll let the cameras in. As you say, we won't let them film the anointing or the Holy Communion at the end, but they'll see the rest of it. And it was a great democratic triumph, wasn't it?
And amazing to think, of course, that Winston Churchill was the Queen's Prime Minister, her first Prime Minister. I mean, astonishing.
Yeah.
But no, it was wonderful. And then, of course, it was the most incredible spectacle. So it just looked incredible, and all the world was there, and all the Commonwealth were there.
Yes, the Commonwealth had to be there. I mean, it was... I mean, one of the problems with the guest list was that they had to find lots of seats for all the new member states of the Commonwealth who expected to be there in number, hundreds of them in some cases. And that meant turfing out other people. But you know, as the Queen pointed out, I'm Queen of these other countries. They've got to be there too. And so it was very telling, wasn't it, on her coronation gown. Actually,
Norman Hartnell had all, and I've seen it, it's the most astonishing thing, a very, very beautiful gown with all the emblems of all the territories, not only of the United Kingdom, but the territories that she was queen of. So it's the end of Imperial Britain, it's the beginning of an equal Commonwealth, and she's this amazing symbol, both of continuity and change. So the preparations for this ceremonial were really astonishing. No bigger event has ever happened in Britain. An army of people, the palace, and of course at Westminster Abbey, were delighted to be joined by a key participant that day, James Wilkinson, who was an 11-year-old chorister at Westminster Abbey. James, welcome. What a day.
Thank you. Yes, it was. And of course, it all began for us 16 months beforehand, in February 1952, when King George VI died, and we were having a Latin lesson in our school, which overlooks Dean's Yard in the shadow of Westminster Abbey. And the first hint we had that anything was happening was the tenor bell on the Abbey was tolling once every minute, something it only does on the death of a sovereign or of a dean in office. Then we saw the flag on Victoria Tower come down at half-mast, and the headmaster came in and said the king had died. And we were all terribly excited because it was going to mean new coins and new stamps with the Queen's head on them. And we all collected stamps in those days. And then, of course, we were told that it was going to be a coronation. We didn't really know much about what the coronation was or what we'd have to do. But we were told that it was going to be a pretty special event, and we were all pleased about that, except for the senior boys in the school who would have left by the time the coronation actually happened, over a year later. But on the day itself, well, on the night before the coronation, we'd had a lot of rehearsal during the previous weeks, and we were all very excited, and we had a pillow fight in the dormitory because it was a boarding school. And then in the next morning, we were woken up at about 4:30 by the sound of the people in the stands outside the Abbey, you know, the people
who
are watching.
Just before we get on to that, because we're going to come on to the day of in a minute, but perhaps if I could just rewind a little bit and ask you, James, could you tell us what your bit of memorabilia you brought along with you today is?
Because I've got the service book that we had as members of the choir,
oh,
with
wonderful.
All the music in it. And my coronation ticket, of course.
You needed a ticket, even though you were in the choir.
Well, we did. We all had to. Yes, there was one person. Actually, there were two who got into the Abbey without a ticket. One was
the
a member.
Queen of the Duke.
Well, I don't know about their tickets, but we had one member of the staff in the choir school who refused to have a seat in the stands outside as they were offered, and nobody quite understood why. But basically, she was for the French teacher, and she persuaded the member of the staff who was going to take the probationers in, the young boys who weren't in the choir but were sitting in the triforium. That's a bit just beneath the clear story. She persuaded him to take her in as well. And they bunched all the tickets together, the boys' tickets and his, and they went straight, and the policeman didn't ask to see individual tickets, and they were all waved
in. So there was a gatecrasher.
There were two gatecrashers. The other one was the wife of the receiver general, who was the chief lay officer at the Abbey. And she knew the little secret entrances into the Abbey. She knew where they were, and so she slipped in just during the service.
But it must have been an astonishing thing to be part of, and you must have spent ages preparing.
Well, we had the music a month or two beforehand because they had newly commissioned music for the coronation, of course. So we had to rehearse that. We had, in particular, the Te Deum at the end of the coronation by Sir William Walton. He came to rehearse us. And we were slightly nervous of this because, you know, it was quite an unusual piece for us. It was a lot of syncopation in it, but a lovely piece of music, which is, I think is going to be at the same, is going to be performed at the King's coronation as well.
Were you sort of encouraged to not use your voices too much before? I mean, were there sort of moments in the run-up to it where you had to sort of not speak for hours on end?
No, we didn't actually sing any services. The Abbey closed on the 1st of January 1953 completely. For its preparation.
So
the
it had sort of effectively 6 months to get ready.
Well, five months to get ready.
Whereas
yes.
this coronation, I think it's more like a fortnight.
A couple of weeks, yes. Mind you, it's very going to be different because last time with 8,000 people, they had to put in new stands right up to the...
To build a football stadium inside Norman Abbey.
It was almost unrecognisable, actually, during the process of building it. I mean, there was a railway line laid down in the Abbey from the west door to the transepts and then branch lines into the transepts. So they could bring in all the hundreds of tons of stanchions and scaffolding and wood and so on. But then, yes, it was an amazing spectacle. We had rehearsals in the Abbey, a couple of rehearsals the week before the coronation. And I can remember my first instinct when I went into the Abbey and climbed up into our places. The spectacle was amazing. The lights for the films and the television brought out all the amazing colour, the gold and the blue carpets and the light blue frontals to the stalls. And during the day itself, the sparkling, I always remember the sparkling jewellery in the turbans of the Indian princes who came along. I mean, it was an astonishing sight.
We're going to come on again to the some of those memories of the actual service in a minute. I'm keen to also reflect on the fact that, I mean, that this ceremony, you were there obviously providing the music, which is such an important part of it, but there was a sort of cast of really hundreds of people, and some of them were very important, archbishops, knights of the garter and so on. There were great war heroes and members of the aristocracy whose role was to process with important pieces of regalia like the crown or the sceptre. And coming behind them were the page boys, the people who had to carry their coronets, because if you were a peer of the realm, you needed a coronet to put on the moment the queen was crowned and when you were paying your homage, but obviously you couldn't carry it. So they had page boys. And I'm delighted to say we've got one of them with us here today, Julian James. Julian, hello.
Hello.
Can you just tell us, in a nutshell, who you were the page to and how you were chosen?
I was the page to Admiral Lord Cunningham. And the story of being chosen is a strange one. I think he had a number of possible candidates to tea on different days. And my grandfather had been a colleague of his in the Navy. And with Lord Cunningham having no children, he came to my grandfather and said, would your grandson consider being one of my pages? So we went to tea one day, and I passed around the scones and all that sort of jazz, and obviously didn't make a complete nonsense of it. And then was told about a fortnight later that I'd been lucky enough to be selected.
How old were you at the time?
14.
14. And so having got this news, I mean, you must have been very excited, but could you tell people?
No, I was told that I could only tell one person. And a friend of mine in my house at Charterhouse.
You were at school at Charterhouse at the time.
Yes. Yeah. Was one David Dimbleby, whose name you will ring a call.
Would that be David Dimbleby, son of Richard Dimbleby, who was the great commentator on the coronation?
It would indeed.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. So your secret was safe with him.
So I told him and had to keep it under wraps from everyone else.
And just before we move on, let me just ask you, what did you actually have to wear? Because, James, I'm presuming you were in a chorister's cassock.
Cassock and surplice.
Cassock and surplice. What did you have to wear, Julian?
Well, I think the simplest thing is, may I just step behind me and show you?
Please do.
Would that work?
Yes, we're going to have a look at the uniform. Oh, my goodness. Look at that. I mean, that's... Wesley, how would you describe that?
Well, it's like something out of a very grand pantomime. It's sort of 18th century court dress with wonderful gold braid and a sort of navy blue. And I presume there was a hat to match. It's the most wonderful outfit.
There was, which thankfully one didn't have to wear on the day.
But that was some sort of tricorn hat, presumably.
It was a sort of naval type hat with a feather.
So going back to this epoch-making morning, June the 2nd, 1953, so it was a cold and wet day despite being June. The atmosphere in London was astonishing. 30,000 people had slept overnight to match the 30,000 troops that were preparing in hundreds of tents where they stayed. London was a huge sort of stage set, really, and you two were at the centre of it. So, James, first of all, you tell us your day.
Well, we woke up at 4:30 because of the noise from the people in the stands outside the Abbey. We got up, I sat on the windowsill looking into Dean's Yard where there was a big marquee where all the stewards came at 4:00 in the morning to have their breakfast before they went into the Abbey. And then we had an early breakfast and went over and had a short practice in the song school, waited for the Chapel Royal choristers to join us. And then we had this regalia procession. We went into the Abbey, followed by the clergy carrying the regalia, you know, the crown and so on.
And there were lots of other musicians. It wasn't just the Chapel Royal. I think it was St. Paul's.
St. Paul's, St. George's Chapel, Windsor, the full choirs from those places. And then two choristers from a certain cathedrals up and down the country. There are 182 trebles in all. And the total number of musicians was over 400.
Good heavens. And Julian, can I ask your morning? I mean, did you wake up feeling nervous?
I woke up to the news that Everest had been climbed. Never forget that.
Amazing. By Hillary and Tenzing, of course.
Yes, indeed. And then we had to be in the Abbey, I think, between 7:30 and 8. So there was a long wait for the service to begin.
I mean, it's a very boring old question, but I think it's rather relevant in this case, which is, can I ask, what did you have for breakfast?
We had a reasonable, substantial breakfast. I mean, we never had a great breakfast at the school. And we had a picnic lunch in our cassock pockets, which was put there, ham sandwiches, barley sugars, and an apple, which were meant for our lunch. But of course, we had it rather earlier than we should have done.
Julian, what about the pages? What sort of breakfast?
I remember what I had for breakfast. There was a distinct shortage of water for obvious reasons.
So you were told not to drink. I've heard this from other pages, that they were told don't drink any water, which, I mean, today...
I think our biggest fear was wanting to go to the loo at the wrong moment.
Did that apply to the choir, James?
Well, yes, in a way. We did have loos underneath where we were sitting, on the stands underneath, the sort of L stands. In fact, with 8,000 people in the Abbey for most of the day, they had to have quite a number of loos. There were 152 L stands, portable loos, in the Abbey. And the loos in the annex, which was built into the front of the Abbey for the piers and so on, the loos there were plumbed directly into the Westminster sewers. So there was no expense spared when it came to people's comfort.
Right. I'm glad, Julian, you reminded us about the conquest of Everest. I mean, that must have just been, you know, the most extraordinary sort of to cap it all. How could you script that?
I mean, for decades, British climbers had been trying to get to...
World climbers, presumably.
Well, Mallory... You know, Irving, you know, died on the mountain making that attempt 30 years before. So it was a British obsession, it was a world obsession. And this expedition got there a few days before, so maybe the news was held back in some way, but it did somehow make Britain look on top of the world that day, that a New Zealand climber, Hunt, and the Sherpa Tenzing, it's not clear who got to the summit first, that the news came through that morning. It was an astonishing, maybe a piece of news management, maybe incredibly felicitous.
As a prelude to this event, you really couldn't have had a greater lift on that extraordinary morning. But let's now go back to that moment when the Queen arrived at the Abbey, or at least when people thought the Queen had arrived at the Abbey, James.
Yes, well, this was a very classic case. There had been 9 processions into the Abbey before she arrived, including the penultimate one, which was the Queen Mother and Princess Margaret's procession. And the excitement was building. And then there was a sort of flurry at the West End, and everybody thought the Queen had arrived, and everybody stood up. And then, of course, from underneath the organ loft came 2 or 3 cleaners in boiler suits with their carpet sweepers and started to restore the carpet to its pristine format. And everybody laughed and sat down. But, of course, the one person who didn't think it was very funny was the Archbishop of Canterbury. And he said afterwards that he thought there should be... It was an unfortunate anticlimax. And he thought there should be another way of dealing with this sort of thing at the next coronation.
It's very British, of course, but then came the climax. 11:15, something amazing happened.
Yes, the Queen entered the Abbey from the annex, and we started singing the wonderful Parry anthem, I Was Glad, which had been written for the coronation of Edward VII in 1902. It was an interesting story about that, because he was sitting in the nave next to Sir Henry Irving, who was a very famous actor. They didn't know each other. And after this anthem, Irving turned to Parry and said, "Well, I don't think much of the music so far." And Parry didn't say who he was, probably to save face.
And can I just ask, Julian, tell me about where were you when the Queen arrived? I mean, do you remember that moment?
Well, we were waiting to form the procession, and the expectancy was electric. We'd been waiting quite a long time. We were, I think, glad to get underway.
So there's an amazing climax to the Queen's arrival when she passes through the nave and gets into the screen, and there's a traditional thing which is part of the parry but shouted by Westminster schoolboys.
Yes, well, the Westminster Queen Scholars, there are 40 of them, and they're the senior academic people in the boys in the school, and they sing Vivat Regina Elizabetha. And it goes back for many years. In the past, they had been able to shout out vivats whenever they wanted to. And
meaning long live Queen Elizabeth.
Yes. And their enthusiasm was tamed for Edward VII's coronation, and the vivats were incorporated into the opening anthem. And, of course, at this coronation, it'll be somewhat different, because there are now, for the first time, girl Queen Scholars. So you can hear at the top of the range of singing or shouting this feminine voice.
Vivat Rex, they'll be saying, of course.
Yes, we don't actually know yet how it's being incorporated, but it will be Vivax, Rex, Carlos, or whatever the...
Carolus.
And, of course, the ceremony actually starts with the recognition, when the monarch faces north, south, east, and west, and the congregation are presented to their undoubted queen, I think is the term they use, is it?
Yes, your undoubted queen. There was a slight problem, actually. Despite all the rehearsals, when the queen and her ladies-in-waiting arrived at the high altar, she was meant to genuflect to the high altar with all her ladies-in-waiting. It had been well rehearsed, but she forgot.
She forgot.
And the two bishops either side of her, the Bishop of Durham and the Bishop of Bath and Wells, didn't like to remind her. So it never happened.
And then after that, of course, we come to what we're going to hear a little bit of now, which is the actual oath.
Will you solemnly promise and swear to govern the peoples of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the Union of South Africa, Pakistan, and Ceylon, and of your possession and the other territories to any of them belonging or pertaining, according to their respective laws and customs?
I solemnly promise so to do.
Interesting there, James, you talk about one or two things that didn't necessarily follow the script, such as the Queen forgetting to curtsy to the altar. Did anything else go wrong?
Well, one or two things that might have gone wrong. I mean, for example, in the first anthem, I Was Glad, there's a very quiet part, O Pray for the Peace of Jerusalem. And at that moment, there's a huge bang. If you listen to the recording, you can hear it. Somebody dropped something, and it came through on the recording. And then, of course, at the introduction to Zadok the Priest, the other famous anthem, there are a lot of arpeggios at the beginning as the build-up. And if you listen very carefully, you can hear the violins running away with themselves. So it's almost got out of control. And that must have been a nasty moment for Sir William Mackay, who was the organist and director of music.
And Julian, can I ask, did anything go wrong from your point of view? What were the glitches at the page's end of the Abbey?
Well, to be quite honest, I can't answer that because I didn't see anything go wrong. But that may be wishful thinking on my part.
So meanwhile, you were waiting impatiently at the other end of the Abbey to do something.
Yes, I think we had 2.5 hours to wait, and we were very pleased to get under starter's orders.
You were sitting on the steps, weren't you, between the two rows of piers?
I had to go to my own place, which was a position beyond the Queen's chair of estate, near the treasurer of the household, and that's where I handed the wand back to Lord Cunningham.
What did he do with it?
I didn't ask him. I'm afraid I was.
This was his wand of office, of course, yes, which is basically a stick.
That was correct.
So you were a page to a very important figure, because Lord Cunningham, as well as being an admiral of the fleet and a war hero, he was the Lord High Steward on the day, wasn't he?
Indeed, an office which is only, I think, appointed for a coronation.
Yes, so you were a page to a very important figure.
Yes, he carried the crown.
But I understand that there were a few worries, though, in the rehearsals. Do you want to remind us how things hadn't gone entirely according to plan in the run-up?
Yes, my poor co-page felt ill in the dress rehearsal. And so there was a moment which I partly described, when I had to go one way and all the other pages went another. And I spent the 3 days between the dress rehearsal and the actual day worrying as to how I could do both. Luckily, he was fine on the day.
He was fine on the day. Well, that's great. And then I think what obviously for after the oath, we've heard a bit of that, and there was the anointing, which, of course, nobody was allowed to see. And then there is the crowning moment, the great crowning, the investiture, and the moment Sir Edward's crown goes on the Queen's head. I mean, James, could you see that?
Yes. Well, you say that. We couldn't actually see the Queen's head because the Queen is quite small, and she was sitting on the coronation chair, which was facing the altar, so it had its back to the congregation. And she was behind the sort of big pinnacle at the top of the coronation chair. So I could see this. The Archbishop raised the crown very high over her head and then lowered it, and it disappeared behind this pinnacle, presumably sitting onto the Queen's head. And then everybody shouted, God save the Queen. There was a slight worry to start with when this happened because nobody quite knew how to start it. And the peers had to put their coronets on at the same time. And during the rehearsal, the Earl Marshal, who was in charge of the coronation, told them that they had to learn to put the coronet on and shout, God save the Queen, at the same time, which was quite difficult for some of them to do.
I think we might actually just hear that moment.
There must have been an extraordinary impact, apart from the visual spectacle and the sounds. That there must have been, was there a sense of something spiritual even happening?
Well, this was the climax to the coronation. The crowning is the pinnacle moment of the service. And I was determined as an 11-year-old to watch this very carefully because I knew it was a very significant event and I would always remember it. And I leant forward and had a very, very good view of the crowning. We had been told that we were to keep our eyes fixed on the conductor, Sir William Mackay, who was a very arresting character with a terrible fiery temper. But I was determined to put that to the back of my mind and to actually watch this historic event taking place.
So what was the impact of that on you, do you think, and on the person being crowned?
Well, I think you can't have the sort of ceremonies that go on at a coronation. You can't experience them if you're the sovereign without them having an incredible effect on you. I mean, call it divine intervention or whatever, but the anointing in particular is the most sacred moment of the coronation. The crowning is a secular thing.
And Julian, you must have seen some of this and experienced the vision and the sounds. What do you think the impact was on you? Describe that moment.
I think it was a remarkable moment, a moment one will never forget. It was just a feeling of something very, very special occurring. I would very much hope that a similar feeling will be apparent when the king is crowned in due course.
And then there's one more climactic moment after the crowning when Prince Philip, the beloved husband, has a huge role. All the peers have to pay homage to Her Majesty, and he is the first, and he also personalises it. It's very powerful.
I, Philip, do become your liege man of life and limb, and of earthly worship. And faith and truth I will bear unto you, to live and die, against all manner of folk, so help me God.
So there we hear Prince Philip doing his homage, as they said. And also in the background there, we hear the choir. That's probably you, isn't it, James?
Well, yes, we were singing. We were singing during the homage. In fact, there were five anthems printed in the service book to be sung during the homage, but nobody would actually know how long the homage was going to take. So we actually only had three of those anthems. And in order to tell us which one we were going to sing, there was a little boy sitting on the organ, a console, and he held up a number. So we knew which one's the next one to come. But the homage is also interesting because the Queen was sitting on her throne on the dais. And in order to pick up the words that were being said by Prince Philip and the others, there was a BBC microphone which had been put into the chair. It was attached to the leg of the throne with a wire going underneath the carpet below the throne. And this microphone was gilded so it wouldn't be noticeable. Now, where is that microphone today? If the BBC still has it somewhere in an attic, it would be an extraordinarily interesting
artifact.
The golden
microphone, how wonderful. Well, listen, okay, let's come to the end of this great day, because unfortunately we don't have too much time left. But I just wonder if I could ask you firstly, Julian, how you were feeling at the end of the service.
A huge sense of relief that one hadn't made an obvious mistake. You know, one was in front of millions of people. And I think one's parents and grandparents must have gone through absolute hell watching in case one made a boob at the vital moment. But also, and supremely, a feeling of great privilege and honour to have been at a very, very special occasion.
So, James, you've been involved with the Abbey your whole life. Even to this day, you edit the Westminster Abbey Review, and you've had a fantastic broadcasting career as well. So where does this event stand in your life's memories?
Well, it must be at the top, really. I mean, a unique occasion, the first, the only one since, for 70 years. And I remember it extremely well. And I wrote a little account of it at the time, actually, in my schoolboy handwriting. So I suppose that was the introduction to my career as a journalist.
And this coronation in 2023, does this stand as a significant event that will be the beginning of a new era?
Well, one hopes that it will be a beginning of a new era, a better era than we've had. You know, we're up against it at the moment as a country. Unfortunately, I don't think this one is going to be as spectacular, anything like as spectacular as the last one. The last one was absolutely unique, and it will never happen again.
But this will reflect modern Britain.
Yes, it'll be a pared-back coronation. There's been much less time to prepare for it. I mean, in the Queen's coronation, Queen Elizabeth's coronation, there were months to prepare the Abbey to get new clothes, new dresses for the peers, new furniture made. Looking at the furniture, for example, the 7,000 new chairs and stools that were being made, they had to be stuffed to a very precise formula.
Well, sadly, there are also no mountains to climb this time, unless a British astronaut lands on Mars or does something amazing. We won't have the Everest moment. But I think we all wish it well. But I think it would be nice to finish today just by hearing Her Majesty's own thoughts, because later in the day, when it was all over, she addressed the nation. And this is a little of what she said.
Parliamentary institutions, with their free speech and respect for the rights of minorities, and the inspiration of a broad tolerance in thought and its expression, all this we conceive to be a precious part of our way of life and outlook. As this day draws to its close, I know that my abiding memory of it will be not only the solemnity and beauty of the ceremony, but the inspiration of your loyalty and affection. I thank you all from a full heart. God bless you all.
Powerful words, and she really fulfilled that. And I think actually a coronation is an epoch-making event. There's no other country in the world does it. This ceremony goes back to 973, in the Abbey to 1066. So I think that what is happening in 2023 will reverberate down the ages, because it's an epic thing in British history.
Well, very sadly, we have reached the end of the first episode of Tea at the Palace. It just remains for me to thank our excellent guest, Julian James, thank you very much, and James Wilkinson, thank you, and Wesley, I think I'll see you again very soon for another cup of tea at the Palace.
Oh, what fun this has been. Please like and leave a review of the show on Apple or whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. Tea at the Palace is a Folding Pocket production.